entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hi there and a good morning. Welcome in. It's the first day of the brand new month of September. I think that means fall is coming. Rich Kimble and Gary Haskell with you. It's the best of Downtown. Brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Just two conversations on the program this Sunday morning because they're both lengthy and pretty darn awesome. One of our favorite guests, the great Paula Poundstone, who returns to Maine next weekend for a couple of shows at the Criterion in Bar Harbor and at the Stone Mountain Arts Center in Brownfield. Kerry Haskell talked with her, and both of us had a chance to talk recently with Hollywood legend Peter Bogdanovich. Let's get things underway first, though, by talking comedy, cats. What else did you cover with Paula Poundstone?
Hoverboards, cake, venues.
There you go.
Travel. A little bit of everything.
A typical conversation with Paula Poundstone here on the Best of Downtown.
The last time you were on was with us was just after Bastille Day, and we talked a little bit about the hoverboard riding Frankie Zapata. Did you see shortly after that that he has made a crossing of the English Channel on that board?
Oh, no, I didn't. But I hope that I told you that, you know I don't, certainly I don't get paid for this interview, but, you know, a nice compensation would be one of those boards.
They are very cool, and you did mention it last time, and we passed that preference for either a hoverboard or chocolate cake onto our friend of Downtown, Amy Rader, who's the executive director down at the Criterion Theater in Bar Harbor, and I can verify that one of the two will be waiting for you next Saturday.
I have a feeling I'm going to be flying a chocolate cake. yeah, boy, that does look so cool. And by the way, no, I have no memory. My short-term memory is just, it's not there anymore. I don't know what happened to it. I think it's stress. Okay, aging isn't helping, I'm sure, but I do think it's largely stress because I've had memory problems for years. When my kids were little, I used to sometimes drive past the house, and my kids would say, "You're driving past the house," and I would turn and say, "Who the hell are you, and what are you doing in my car?" So it's not a new thing, having memory problems.
But. Wait. Yeah, the more you have on your plate, I think the harder it is to keep track of everything that's there.
Honestly, I don't know how anybody did. You know, I'm reading a book about Marie Antoinette, and they just did nothing for themselves, the royalty. And by the way, that was not her choice. Let me just come to Marie Antoinette's defense for a minute.
I think long overdue.
That was not her choice. They were. You know, there were certain traditions behind the court in France, and that was one of them, was that everything got done for the royalty. I was thinking about it. She was 20 years old, I believe, when she became queen. Not when she went there, not when she was first a princess, but when she became queen because the king died. I think she was 20. And, you know, take an American girl who's 20... who already thinks the world revolves around her. I can't, you know, it was a recipe for disaster for sure.
Sort of a no-win situation for her, and
it kind of was. I mean, I have all my kids are young adults now, but you know, if my girls from their teenage years, there is a brain development thing where they don't necessarily think of others a lot. And me too. I shouldn't just say them. I think I certainly went through that as well, where I just had a thing where I thought about myself a tremendous amount. And so, you know, let them eat cake isn't far away from that.
Well, you just need to round up a couple of ladies in waiting, and then you can take some of that pressure off and keep track of stuff better.
Yeah. She had someone to put on, like, her nightgown. She had someone, you know, like... And I don't think they were the same person who dressed her in the morning. You know, there were shifts. There was someone who put on her nightgown. I don't even own a nightgown, for heaven's sakes, and that's because I'm not staffed well enough.
Now, after the French Revolution, you got to think the people that had those jobs, the nightgown dresser, had a little trouble finding work after that, you would think.
Yeah. Yeah, there weren't a lot of, but yeah, plus you didn't really want that on your resume. I definitely, I have to staff up. I have 13 cats. Not one of them will dress me.
They got to get a little bit of training, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. People think you can't train cats. And by the way, that is not true. I use a water pistol and it does work. I mean, you can't train them to do extraordinary things, but you can, you know, but you can get them off the kitchen counter.
I will pick up a squirt gun because mine just will do nothing that I ask him to do. He just stares at me blindly.
Yeah, well, a squirt gun kind of does work for negative behaviors. It doesn't mean they won't do it while you're not there, but you know, in front of you, you can.
That's really the best you can hope for with a cat.
Yeah. Yes. Now I have I have two dogs. I have one that's a German Shepherd mix, and one that is a puppy that is part part Golden Retriever and part Newfoundland. And she's only about 7 months old, but she's about the same size as the German Shepherd. And yesterday morning, she's very good. She tells me when she needs to go out. I sleep on the floor, so yesterday morning I woke up with her face over mine at 7:10 in the morning, and then she just dropped one of those big Kong things onto my face.
That's one way to wake up.
It's great. You don't get that at a hotel. You don't go, could you drop the Kong on my face at 7:10, please?
Now, yeah. I have to talk with you a little bit about your wonderful podcast, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, that you do with Adam Felber. There's so much to love about it as a listener, but what's your favorite thing about doing, creating the podcast?
My favorite thing is that there are no suits. You know, you're not answering to anybody. So you just, if you have an idea and you think it sounds like fun, you know, you throw it up on the wall. And the only problem is there's not a lot of ways of measuring response.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's really just me and my co-creators and, you know, it's and the engineer, you know, we're like, yeah, we think that's funny. So in that way, it's sort of a person who's been, I've been doing my job for 40 years. And it's a very, as a stand up, I have a very instantaneous response. And it guides me, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of the North Star of the performance is obviously the audience's reaction. Now, in a podcast, you really don't have that at all. All you have is like on Facebook, we have a Facebook page for the show, and people will occasionally write stuff. And I always say to my manager and co-producer Bonnie, Captain Crinkle Burns, when, she'll go, oh, we got a lot of response. And I'll go, well, what does that mean? And she'll say, well, two people wrote in. I go, you know, scientifically, it's not a data point at all. So that part is a little challenging, figuring out if you're on the right track or not. But we're having fun. I guess that's the best you can ask for. I'll tell you, you're not going to pay your rent with a podcast.
No, but I'll give you feedback from my point. It's as much fun as you guys are having doing it, it's that much fun to listen to.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I do enjoy it. There were a couple things in the latest one. Now, Adam, immediately, when you were talking about your shopping trip
in Manchester.
Now, he immediately, red and white stripes, he went to clown pants. And I want to come to your defense a little bit here. My mind immediately went to Uncle Sam pants.
Well, there. See, that's because you have a lot more respect for me than does Adam Felber. you're both wrong. I mean, I wasn't describing them very well, I guess, because it was it's a red stripe with some amount of decorum. It's you would know from Bar Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Bar Harbor women would wear a billowy light thin red striped pant. You know, it's sort of a not necessarily après swim, but maybe you know, it's for the hot steamy weather.
Yeah, it's for warm weather, beach adjacent.
Yes. Exactly. And, you know, Manchester is, you know, the town's name is Manchester by the Sea, but that's only for the effete. I still call it Manchester. But, yeah. He see, Adam assumes everything I do is clownish. I fell right into his clownish trap. Actually, you know, my new, well, I shouldn't say my new, my only and new rap song that is about the let's see, the loss of the original Butterfinger.
A sad occasion, by the way.
A really sad occasion. They're idiots. It comes my rap song about it comes out. I can't remember if it's the. This week or next week, I can't remember anymore. But it's very, very sort of something I've been working on on the podcast. I've worked with some rappers on writing and producing a rap song, and it's really achieved. It's going to sweep the nation. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. So for listeners who don't know, Butterfingers, which are you know arguably one of the best, you know. OTC candies there are
in my top five, definitely.
Yeah, it's delicious. It's the crispy, crunchy nougat that I especially appreciate. It's been bought by a different company, and at first the way I found out was that I bought some Butterfinger the really small ones, the Butterfinger chips, and I popped one or two in my mouth. And they tasted disgusting. And I was like, well, maybe I just got a bad one. And I tried again. It was horrific. And then I thought, well, you know, they must be out of date or something. Must have expired. And when I eventually looked at the bag that I was eating out of, there was a alarming red corner that they had, you know, put on the bag, this red decorative corner. And on it, it said, new improved recipe. And you will find that it is not improved in any way. It's absolutely disgusting. And it turns out it was bought by a different company. And they think they've done the right thing. They say that, oh, people just don't like change. No, they don't like change when you go from eating a delicious Butterfinger to eating mud. Yes. They don't like change.
That's not a good, it's not change for the better, right? That's a problem. We're talking with Paula Poundstone, who has two shows coming up next week here in Maine. On Friday, September 6th, she'll be at the Stone Mountain Art Center, and on Saturday, September 7th, at the Criterion in Bar Harbor. Now, one last thing on the podcast.
I must be the luckiest person in the world, by the way, that I'm not only going to Maine, but to perform at two of my favorite venues back to back. There'll be no living with me after that.
They are both really, really good venues. You know, the Criterion's a little closer for us, but the Stone Mountain Arts Center is just a wonderful venue for performances.
It's crazy, that place, the Stone Mountain Arts Center. It's Carol Noonan, who's a musician, hated the life of, you know, of traveling around in a van with musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And so she turned her barn into a venue.
That's she did it the absolute correct way out there.
Oh, my gosh. It's great. I think, you know, as an audience member and a performer, what you benefit from is, you know, her experience as a musician. It's like she knew all the good things to do. To make the venue great. So anyways, I'm looking forward to that. And then, of course, you know, who doesn't want to go to Bar Harbor? Find me the person who doesn't want to go to Bar Harbor. They don't exist.
September in Bar Harbor is a great time of year. And the Criterion Theater is just a beautiful, the Art Deco touches in that they've restored it to. It's a beautiful looking space.
It's going to be great. I was there, I think, either once or twice before. I can't remember anymore. My old neighbor, Foster Stroop, lives in Bar Harbor, by the way, in case you're looking for her.
One last thing about the latest podcast. Again, coming to your defense, Adam referred to your landline as being stupid, and I, as you know, having to do interviews fairly frequently, I am the first to jump to your defense on that one. That thank you for keeping a landline.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have a crinkly sound while we're talking. We sound like we're almost in the same room together. Yeah. People, you know, the cell phone is overrated in every way. And by the way, when I say cell phone, of course I mean flip phone.
Now, you're coming to Maine next weekend. You're in, New Jersey this weekend. Have you gotten traveled down to a science for yourself?
You know, I'm pretty good at it. I got to tell you something. As I told you, I've been doing this for 40 years. Mm. It was only a couple of months ago that I had this idea to write in black magic marker a large letter J on both sides of each of the pieces of luggage that I check. And it has changed my baggage life. You know how they go, many bags look alike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? Many bags really do look alike. And so as I'm standing there at the baggage claim, I'm always trying to find, like, my red bag doesn't have four wheels. It only has two wheels. It's a little older. And my dark green bag looks the same as they really do. Many bags look alike.
And absolutely.
So I'm standing there trying to look at the minute features. and I've had the experience of taking someone else's bag. One time I was almost to the hotel when the person called me. and they had my bag and I had their bag. And I also had the experience not very long ago, which is that I was sort of one of the last people down to the baggage claim. And as I'm walking towards the baggage claim, I can see from a distance another passenger with my bag in his hand. And the only reason I saw it from a distance was because of the large letter J that I had written on the outside of the bag. This is my genius travel tip for everyone.
That's some great life advice right there.
It really, because, you know, and I thought of my assistant was like, well, you're going to write on the luggage? Like I was making this beautiful luggage unattractive. Okay, luggage, attractive is not its job. I don't care if it's attractive. It has nothing to do with it. And I know some people put like a yarn or something. This is just, you cannot miss. And I can send someone else to get the luggage if I had to, too. I go, you can't miss it. Got a large J on both sides of the bag. And by the way, one J I accidentally wrote backwards. So it has a large dyslexic J on one side.
I would rather have ugly luggage that I can find than beautiful luggage that somebody else takes.
Well, precisely. The point of the luggage is to protect the stuff inside of it, not to be decorative. Now, of course, I've told everyone what my luggage looks like, and I'll never find it again.
Well, I think you can lay claim to anybody else that does it at this point, they can't use the letter J.
Yeah, definitely not.
Pick another letter.
J is mine.
J is Paula Poundstone's. Paula, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us, and looking forward to seeing you in Maine next weekend.
All right, thank you so much. Take care.
Paula Poundstone talking with Carrie Haskell here on The Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning. When we come back, a real-life Hollywood legend talks about some other Hollywood legends. Peter Bogdanovich next on Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free Maine State inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Summertime is best spent chillaxing. And chillaxing happens best with the flavors of summer at the Ground Round. Right now at the Ground Round in Bangor, savor the summer grilled chicken sandwich. It's a tender chicken breast topped with pepper jack cheese and a citrus garlic fruit salsa on a grilled split top bun served with the Ground Round's house-made pasta. Wash it down with a sangria and round out the meal with the perfect dessert, the strawberry float cake. Seriously, it's amazing. Take your summer chillax to the max with the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor. GroundRound.com.
ClearPoint Capital is excited to be the official financial advisor sponsor of the Maine Black Bears. At ClearPoint Capital, our client relationships are built upon trust, proactive service, state-of-the-art planning tools, and a disciplined investment process. ClearPoint Capital is your financial advocate. Your success is our success. See what our team can do for you and your family. ClearPoint Capital and the Maine Black Bears. Now that's a winning combination.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. Call us today at 307-7718.
The Sea Dog Brewing Company in Bangor is all about new this summer. Don't worry, the Sea Dog still has the same menu, theme nights, and the charm they're known for. But there's a whole lot of new to get excited about. Like the new deck. It's bigger now with a bar facing the water, giving you a great view. This summer, the Sea Dog will also have new weekly food and drink specials. And if you love frozen ones, the Sea Dog has new ice machines to make the best frozen drinks in town. Perfect for those hot summer days. Going to a waterfront concert? Make the Sea Dog your go-to before and after. It's the closest bar to the venue, so it's an easy walk to and from. Plus, they give away a pair of concert tickets to a lucky winner about an hour before each show. And as always, the Sea Dog has theme nights throughout the week, like the Monday Night Social with Riff Johnson, Taco and Margarita Tuesday, Wine Down Wednesday, Wednesday night cornhole from 6 to 8, and live music every Friday and Saturday night. Like Sea Dog Brewing Company Bangor on Facebook for all their upcoming events. We'll see you at the Sea Dog. Sea Dog Brewing Company, Front Street, Bangor, your pre- and post-concert destination.
Fall's almost here. Winter can't be far away. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street in Bangor, wants you to be ready for fall and winter. Bring your vehicle in right now and have it checked out before the cold weather comes. They'll check the battery, antifreeze, shocks, alignment, and much more. Don't wait. For once, be ready when the cold weather arrives. Make your appointment today. Call Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, or check them out on the web at BangorTire.com. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, Bangor. More than just a tire store.
Well, why don't you love me like you used to do? How come you treat me like a worn-out shoe? My hair's still curly and my eyes are still blue. Why don't you love me like you used to do?
Our next guest on Downtown set the world of Hollywood on fire with his first major feature film, The Last Picture Show, earning multiple Academy Award nominations. He went on to direct acclaimed films such as What's Up, Doc, Paper Moon, St. Jack, and some others that weren't big successes, but he's had quite a career as both a director and actor and as a film historian, getting to know people like John Ford and Orson Welles. We had a wonderful time talking recently with Hollywood legend Peter Bogdanovich.
Hi, Rich. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
I totally unexpected. The other night I was searching the dial and came upon the wonderful Buster Keaton documentary on TCM. Boy, that was terrific. And I was surprised to learn that you never got to meet Buster Keaton.
No, I didn't. I was just... I had discovered where he was living at that time, about five blocks from where I was living. And then he died before I could get to him.
Well, it's a wonderful love letter to him. How important is he in the history of film?
Well, I think in terms of comedy, he's right up there with the best. And as a silent filmmaker, he was extraordinary. And those films, a lot of those films really hold up.
Well, yeah, I actually followed it up by watching The General for about, I don't know, maybe the 8th or 10th time, and that just holds up so well and seems to get better with age.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it was a very modern film. I like all the ones that he directed. They're all good. The 10 films that we ended the documentary with. I'm glad you saw it. I didn't know they were running it. I happened to be watching the TCM because they were running Sherlock Jr. or something, and then they said they were running the documentary. I didn't even know they were running it, but I stayed and watched it.
You've been on television a lot lately. You were a key part in that, I thought, terrific CNN series on the movies as well.
Yeah, I think I was in the one of them. This in the 70s, I think.
The others
a little bit in the 70s. What were you saying?
I wanted to talk about The Other Side of the Wind, because we've had a lot of people talk about that with us. Josh Karp, who did the documentary "They'll Love Me When I'm Dead," was on with us. I thought the movie was sensational. Would Orson have been pleased to see that film finally completed?
Oh yeah, he would have very much. I remember. He turned to me once, we were at lunch or something, and out of the blue, he just turned to me, he said, "If anything ever happens to me, I want you to promise me you'll finish the picture." And I said, "Oh, Orson, nothing's going to happen to you." He said, "I know, but if it does, I want you to promise me you'll finish the picture." I said, "Oh, yeah, all right, of course I will." And that's what happened.
Well,
it took 20 years or something to finish it.
And it's remarkable because you watch that film, and here's a movie that had been worked on in various stages since the 1970s, and it's still ahead of its time.
Yeah, exactly. It is still ahead of its time. And it was 40 years in the making, so to speak.
I think your book, with your conversations, This is Orson Welles, I feel like it's the definitive look at Orson. I know you had a falling out with him for a while, but you did reconcile before his death.
Yes, we did, yes. I'm happy to say we did. We didn't really have a falling out. It was a difficult situation with a movie that he had sort of wanted to make. It's a long story, but we did reconcile. And we had a very nice conversation. I remember a couple of weeks before he died, I said to him, "Jesus, Orson, I feel like I made so many mistakes." And he said, rather with a light tone, he said, "Well, it does seem to be impossible to go through life without making a great many of them."
He's such a giant in film. I mean, everything he touched, theater, radio as well. But is there a danger that his impact on cinema might be forgotten by new generations?
I don't think so. I think he's pretty interesting to younger people because he was such an inspiration at a young age. I mean, made Citizen Kane at 25. Mm. I don't know how he did that. And not only that, but his performance is so brilliant in that movie.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich here on Downtown. What did you learn from your time working with Roger Corman?
How to steal shots. He said, if you can't get it legally, steal it. So we did. We did some stuff. I made a picture called Targets with him in 1960. Came out in 1968, and you're not allowed to even go near the freeway. And we shot on the freeway and at the freeway. I worked with Roger on another picture prior to that called The Wild Angels with Peter Fonda, Nancy Sinatra. And I was kind of I was an uncredited writer. I rewrote about 80% of the script for him. And I worked as his assistant, but also did the second unit, which wasn't second unit because I was working with the leads, with Fonda and Sinatra and Bruce Stern and so on. That picture was his most successful film to date, to that date. And I mean, it cost nothing. It cost anything. 300,000 grossed about 10 million. So it was a huge hit in its day. So he offered me the opportunity to make my own film that I would direct. And he gave me a proposal, which was, you know, impossible. I mean, he wanted me to shoot he said Boris Karloff owed him 2 days' work and wanted me to shoot 20 minutes with Karloff in 2 days and then use 20 minutes of Karloff footage from a dreadful movie they made called The Terror. And then shoot with other actors for 10 days and shoot another 40 minutes, and he would have a new Karloff picture. He said, "Are you interested?" I said, "Well, I guess so." It was a chance to make my own picture. Then we wrote a script, and he read it and said, "This is the best script I've ever had to produce." But I don't know how you can possibly shoot it. Shoot Karloff's stuff in 2 days. You're going to have to cut it back. I said, if we cut it back, Roger, it won't be the best script you ever read again. It was pretty tight. He said, well, go ahead and cut it. So I didn't cut it. I just persisted and rewrote the ending a bit. We finally twisted his arm, and he came up with a total of 5 days. And I learned how to work quickly, and not to cover myself with shots that I might need, only shoot things that I know I will need. And I've done that pretty much throughout my career. I've only shot what I needed, you know.
How was Karloff to work with?
Oh, wonderful. Real pro. He was a terrific man. And he was an established star, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew who he was. And so we played variations on that in the movie. I mean, it was the first time I had basically constructed a movie for a star that was familiar to the public. And he was just wonderful to work with. A real professional. And he was no kid. He was 79 at the time. He had braces on both his legs. He had a fairly bad case of emphysema, which made it difficult for him to walk and talk at the same time. But he never complained, and he did it all. He stayed at, I think, the drive-in sequence. We spent a whole day and a night with him. He was up until 5 in the morning. And never complained. He was really a hard act to follow.
Looking at your films, Peter, always seem to have great parts and great performances by women. Why do you feel you know women so well?
I don't know if I do. I like women. And I think, you know, I've been offered a number of pictures that I turned down because there's no good women's parts. I want to make sure there's a good woman's part in anything I do. And I don't know. I find women intuitive, very intuitive, and very smart in ways that men aren't as smart. And I don't know. I'm bored with the idea of doing an all-male picture or something like that. I've turned down a couple of those, like The Last Detail and Boys in the Bank. I mean, what they called it, women. They call it, Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember somebody offered me The Last Detail, and I said, no, I don't want to do it. Why not? There's no women in it. Anyway.
Now, away from film, you've had quite a history with women as well. Is it possible that you love women, at least at a time in your life, you loved women too much to be with one?
Well, no, I always wanted to be with one, and I was with Sybil for about 8 or 9 years. Polly was about the same length. And Dorothy and I were going to get married, but he was murdered before we could do it.
That story is so sad, and I saw an interview with you a while back, and you talked about it. To this day, you in a sense, dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder after the death, the murder of Dorothy Stratton.
Yes, that's true. I noticed it, yeah. It's quite severe, you know. What happens is you get very anxious about things, and you start wondering why somebody hasn't gotten home yet or something, you know. It gets kind of just, you can't help it. I guess you can't help it. It was traumatic experiences, for sure.
I want to talk about some of the people you've worked with in your film career. Jeff Bridges, really his first big role in Last Picture Show. He earned an Oscar nomination for that. Now, he was dating Sybil, and then you began dating Sybil. But how was that work relationship?
Well, he was with Sybil for a couple of weeks on that picture. And then she left. I mean, he left to do his army reserve training order. And Sybil and I got interested in each other way too much. And anyway, occupational hazard. week sober. What else did you do?
But you were able to get past that, though, and you obviously worked very well together.
Oh, yeah, we got along very well. She was terrific at pictures.
You also had great success teaming with Ryan O'Neal. Did other people in Hollywood fail to understand his strengths as an actor?
I guess they did. I directed him very carefully and very much, and fed him a lot of things, particularly on What's Up, Doc. A lot of you could almost say he was doing me doing Cary Grant, because I would show him how to do it, and he did it well. Paper Moon, I think, is his best performance that he ever gave in any picture. He really understood that guy and was a little bit like that guy in life. So he was pretty difficult on in the last picture we did, Nickelodeon. It just wasn't a good experience.
Talking with Peter Bogdanovich here on The Best of Downtown. More to come. The second part of our conversation after this break at Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
What makes a community thrive? The people who live in it. When you use your First National Bank Visa debit card at participating local businesses, you save on everyday purchases while supporting the people who work day in and day out to make your town a vibrant, unique community. Receive cash back on purchases and support the local businesses that make our communities thrive. Bank local, buy local. Learn more at dreamfirstrewards.com. First National Bank, dream first because you can. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Central Street Farmhouse, downtown Bangor, for the best home brewing ingredients, equipment, and advice that you'll find anywhere. Plus, make your own wine right in the store. How does that work? Pick a wine kit, make an appointment, and whip up 6 gallons of the best wine you'll ever taste in less than 30 minutes. 2 months later, come back to bottle it and take it home. They offer these wine classes every day they're open, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Call 992-4454 or see them on Facebook to find out more.
Before Dylan, before Cash, there was Guthrie. Penobscot Theater Company presents Woody Guthrie's American Song, Songs and Writings of America's Premier Folk Poet, Woody Guthrie. An exuberant musical celebration of our nation. Bring the whole family to Woody Guthrie's American Song, September 5th to the 29th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
A kiss, a sigh is still a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
From the soundtrack of What's Up, Doc, Barbara Streisand, and As Time Goes By, keep that in mind. Remember that moment as we continue our conversation with the legendary Peter Bogdanovich. One of my favorite actors that you worked with and had terrific success with him. And I went back and rewatched St. Jack recently, and you worked with Ben Gazzara on that, and they all laughed. He is another guy, I think, underappreciated when people look back at film. And the movie itself, St. Jack, is just terrific.
Thank you. I like that picture, too. I think Benny, you're right, Benny was very underrated and should have, you know, he should have played the... I saw him on the Broadway stage, you know, in his first thing that he did, End as a Man by Calder Willingham. He was extraordinary. He was a flat-out star first on the stage. And he should have played the lead in Hatful of Rain, which he did on the stage brilliantly. He should have played the lead in Cat instead of Paul. Newman's all right, but Gazzara was extraordinary in that production. I saw that on Broadway. He was a great actor. And a real artist, rare in this business.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich, another actor you worked with on They All Laughed. John Ritter, I knew you were also very, very good friends with him. A brilliant comedic actor, but I always thought he was an actor who had a lot of depth that people always didn't tap into.
Well, that's the problem, yeah. I had a chance to cast him in the last picture show, and I always regretted that I didn't cast him. I should have, but I got talked out of it. And I would have wished he could have done that, because then he would have had a dramatic role and started his career as opposed to comedy. And I think he would have been given the opportunity to play a lot more diverse kind of parts. He's a very good dramatic actor, besides me. Because I always say, if you can play comedy, you can do anything.
Which part were you hoping to cast him in Last Picture Show?
The part Tim Bottoms played.
Oh, wow.
I have a diary where I said I'm going to cast John Ritter, and then I didn't. Wow. And I kicked myself for years. And then he became a very close friend of mine.
I understand, even though the film did very well, and she was much acclaimed for it, you didn't have a great experience working with Cher.
No, she was a pain in the neck. She's very good in the picture in that, but I had to really be very careful how I shot her, because she couldn't sustain a scene. In other words, if we had a scene that was four pages and I wanted to shoot it in one shot, for example, as I've often done, she couldn't do that. She couldn't sustain the scene. She'd start off well, but then she'd go off somewhere off the track. So I just shot a lot of close-ups of her, because in the close-up, I can direct her in the close-up while she's doing it. And I can also get in close so I can see her eyes. She has had a very good eyes in terms of sadness. She seemed to have the sadness of the world in her eyes. When you get to know her, you find out it's just self-pity, but it translates very well in close-ups.
So I think
more close-ups of her in that picture than I ever did of anybody.
So I think that answers the question. A good director can make somebody look like a good actor, even if perhaps they're not that gifted.
Oh, yeah, sure. There's a lot of tricks to that.
You wrote
not just tricks, but also, you know, you say, you show them how to do it. You know, mm-hmm. You say, try this.
And you've given actors line readings for a long, long time. Have any of them been bothered by that?
Yeah, some of them have. Some of them tell me they don't like it, so I don't do it, unless I have to. Tim Bottoms was one of them. He didn't like line readings, and so I didn't do it. And then, I remember we had one speech that was just, he couldn't get it right. He couldn't get it right, and finally he said, well, okay, how do I say it? And I said, hit, and I told him which word to hit. And then he got it right, finally. But Barbara Streisand, for example, announced that she didn't like line readings, but then she would repeatedly say, okay, how do I say it? I think the actors who objected to it had a kind of insecurity that they felt that it wouldn't look good if I was giving the line readings. But other actors, like Owen Wilson, for example, didn't mind. He'd say, how do you say, how would you say it? So, you know, it depends. I don't do it all the time. If I can get the direction across without doing that, I don't do it. But a lot of times it's just easier to say, try it this way, because by saying it a certain way, the actor gets the sort of subtle difference, you know. Sometimes it's just an intonation that's different. I remember I said to Barbara, "But try this." When you sing that song as time goes by, when you get to that phrase, "On that you can rely," would you hit "can"? She said, "Now you tell me how to sing the fucking song." I said, "Try it," and she sang it. She tried it, and it worked. Anyway, Lubitsch, who's one of my favorite directors, had a thick German accent, and he was short, not particularly attractive guy, and he would act out every single role in every movie. And I asked Jack Benny, who did a picture with him, I said, "Is that true that Lubitsch acted out all the parts?" He said, "Yeah, all the parts, even the maids." And I said, "How was he?" Jack said, "Well, he was kind of broad, but you got the idea."
Is that flexibility of being able to read the actors and know what type of direction they need what separates good directors from really great directors?
I think the acting is key. And if you can't get the right performances, you shouldn't be doing the job. It's all about the acting, you know. If you know where to put the camera, of course, it helps.
You wrote a wonderful book and did a great documentary as well on a Maine native, John Ford, certainly one of the great directors of all time. You got to know him very well. Where does he belong in the history of American cinema?
He's a very important figure. He's one of the few poets, you know. He really made some extraordinary films. Of course, he was great at Westerns and made a number of classic Westerns, Stagecoach and The Searchers by Donny Clementine, Fort Apache. The whole Cavalry trilogy is brilliant. And he was a great director, there's no question. Orson used to say he was the best American director. The only one who's a poet, he said. And he was right. I love Hawks as well. I said to Orson, and so did Orson, I said, "How would you differentiate Hawks and Ford?" And Orson said, "Well, Hawks is great prose, but Ford is poetry."
Ah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
I saw just this week a story that the top 10 grossing movies of this year so far are all either comic book movies, sequels, remakes, or action movies. Are you worried about the future of cinema?
Yeah. Pretty bad. The trouble is the studio system worked for a very simple reason, which was that you had everybody in the company working to make the actors, have the actors be at their best. And all the actors had personalities. They were interesting, you know. They weren't like acting in the theater where, you know, it's all about the acting. But in movies, it was all about the acting, but it shouldn't look like acting. What everybody was trying to get in the golden age of Hollywood was performances where people existed. It was like to be, it was like being as opposed to acting. So that's why John Wayne, Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, those were real stars. And they always played something that was in their range, that worked, that was believable, that wasn't like, as Hitchcock said, you couldn't cast Cary Grant as a killer. The audience wouldn't accept it. Mm-hmm. And the great movie acting is where the character and the actor, where the line between the character and the actor is erased. We don't have that anymore, and we don't have anything to create that. And then Brando came along and wanted to be versatile and not be typed, and And fine, he was great. But the thing was, Marlon had such a key, clear personality of his own that no matter what he did in terms of makeup and the accent and all that, it still had Marlon there. And so that was his, that was what he had. He just was unique no matter what he was playing. Anyway, but the need to be versatile is what we have now with actors. And so we don't have any stars left of the old school. Clint Eastwood, I guess, is the last one.
Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, a groundbreaking television show began. How did you get involved in your role in The Sopranos?
Well, I can't remember how I did this. I was called by David Chase about, I don't remember what it was, early 19. And he said, he's doing a series called Northern Exposure. And they were planning, it was just, I don't remember what year it was 97. It was just after my book on, or 92, I guess, right after my book on Orson came out. And maybe a few months after. And he said, we're doing a special show on Northern Exposure, a kind of a tribute to Orson, where we're going to do a film, supposedly a film festival up here. They were shooting in Seattle, but it was supposed to be Alaska. And he said, he wondered if I would come up there and play myself, so to speak, in a kind of, having just written this book, in a kind of tribute to Orson, who was dead. So I said, sure, and I came up and we did it. And the second day of shooting, he comes over to me and he says, have you acted before? I said, yes. I said, yes, I started out as an actor when I was 15. He said, well, you're very good. He said, you have a lot of presence. You should do it more often. I said, well, thank you. 7 years later, David Chase calls me again. He says, we're doing a series called The Sopranos, which is going into the second season. And we have a therapist who's been working with Tony Soprano, and he's so difficult that now she needs to go to a psychiatrist. Would you like to play that? I said, yeah, sure. So he said, come on down and meet the writers. So I went and met the writers, and they called me about an hour later and said, you got the part. We'd love you to do it, and so I did 15 of those and directed one of them. Mm. It was a great experience. I really loved that. It was tremendous fun. All the actors were great. David was brilliant. Just a great experience.
What's been the biggest learning experience of your career as a director?
I don't know. The greatest learning experience. They're all a learning experience. I don't know really which one I would single out. I think At Long Last Love was the most difficult, and we couldn't. I never did get the cut right until somebody did it for me, and it was really. But the problem with At Long Last Love was that if you're going to make an original musical comedy, you got to preview it a lot of times. I mean, if you're doing it for Broadway, you go out of town for a month or two.
Sure.
To play it on the road. We had exactly two previews. And that was a mistake. And the version that we opened was not even previewed. So it was just pretty good. I learned what not to do on that one. The scenes were good. It just wasn't cut right. I guess that was the most painful learning experience.
If you had to, I'm sure it would be impossible to do, but if you had to, if we pressed you and you had to pick one film to represent your career, what might it be?
That's difficult because I've done so many different kinds of films. I don't know what I would pick. I think probably They All Laughed.
If your films happen to come on television, do you watch? And if you watch, are you able to enjoy, or do you watch with a director's eye and look at things you might do differently today?
I don't really watch my stuff on TV unless it's just like the other day the Keaton picture was on. it caught me by surprise. I didn't know they were going to run it. So I just I watched it since it was there. I thought, well, what the hell? Let's look at it. And I thought it was pretty good.
Peter, thank you so much for making time for us. We've enjoyed your work for so many years, and we appreciate you being with us. We wish you continued success and good health.
Thank you so much, Rich. Good luck with your show, and thanks for the interest.
I think that's the third time I've listened to that interview, Kerry, and I still have to kind of pinch myself and go, we really did spend a half hour talking to Peter Bogdanovich.
It is a bit surreal, but that conversation is one of my favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. That was great. Our thanks to Peter. Our thanks to Paula Poundstone as well. And again, Paula appearing at the Stone Mountain Arts Center Friday night the 6th, and then on Saturday at the Criterion in Bar Harbor. Go see her. You're going to laugh a lot. Barbara Streisand, Paula Poundstone. Maybe Barbara Streisand will show up. You never know.
Special guest. It is right. Bar Harbor in September.
Anything is possible. And it's going to wrap it up for us in the Best of Downtown on this Sunday morning. Lots of good stuff coming in the week ahead for you tomorrow on the show. Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees chats with us, not about the Monkees, but also about the big Beatles tribute show honoring the 50th anniversary of the White Album, coming to the Collins Center with Mickey Dolenz, Christopher Cross, Todd Rundgren, and more. That's tomorrow afternoon. Maine Football's Nick Charlton, Mike Lowe with the Portland Press Herald, Alan Adams of the Maine Edge, all tomorrow at 4, right here on Downtown. You're gonna be